I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Property assessment in Jackson County has caused an uproar with homeowners and business owners and the county legislature. But County Executive Frank White says there's nothing he can do, that his hands are tied by state law. Today, we look at how this property assessment debacle is affecting people. We'll ask how property owners are dealing with the potential increase in taxes and how neighborhoods are getting involved. Then, toxic masculinity is associated with aggression and emotional repression. But what about toxic femininity? Two experts guide us through what might be best called toxic humanity. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. I never thought I'd spent my summer covering something as obscure as the Jackson County Board of Equalization, but here we are. Known as the BOE, it's now at the center of the reassessment mess in Jackson County. It occurred to me that we can talk lots about how property is assessed, whether sales comps were used, whether property was actually physically inspected, but it turned out to be a story about people, and that's what we're going to talk about this morning. My guests are Preston Smith, who represents the Blue Springs School District on the BOE, and we're going to talk about what that exactly means in a moment. But Preston, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Sam.
Alan Young is head of the Ivanhoe neighborhood. Alan, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
And with me, Greg Lombardi. He's head of the Lykins Neighborhood Association. Greg, nice to have you here on Up to Date.
Thank you.
All three of you are deep into this reassessment mess with me. Preston, I'm going to start with you and see if there's any news here. Last week, the BOE at the meeting said it wanted additional information from you and the county assessment department. Has the board told you what they want, and what is that?
Got the email on Friday with the attachments we looked at over the weekend, and about 2 or 3 hours from now, we'll have the submission to send to the board and also the county legislature.
What are they asking for?
Well, I'll tell you what, they asked for quite a bit. They wanted me to at least do an analysis of what my proposal would entail, how it would affect the property taxes in the county if it were enacted, and also do somewhat of an analysis of a rework of the entire county assessments. That would involve like doing market ratios based on sales figures. And believe it or not, I figured out a way to do that too.
Before I move on, I just want to ask, what did you conclude about how your plan would affect county finances?
It would actually increase the assessment revenue from compared to 2017 by 9.5%.
So 9.5% more revenue.
Countywide.
Right.
Talking about a 9.5% increase for the average house.
Right.
Which is a lot more bearable than what we're seeing for a lot of households right now.
Yeah. Alan, I want to go to you. You testified earlier at a BOE meeting. I think you've also talked to county legislators about this. What are you hearing from your neighbors in Ivanhoe? Are they scared, angry, perplexed? What's going on there?
They have a flood of emotions. But particularly fear. We operate at 3700 Woodland at the Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council, and we have tried to be a conduit to help the residents fill out the appeal forms. We have had many people come in that needed help first to fill out the form. And some of the residents were scared to fill out the form because they thought by doing so, the county was going to be able to take their house. So we have both rational and irrational fears as a result of the increases. And a lot of the residents have seen 100% increases. And if you have vacant property, myself, I saw an increase of over 2,000% on one vacant lot.
You, I heard you testify that you're growing vegetables on that lot, correct?
Yes, sir. We grow peppers and tomatoes and just about everything you can think of. And we're proud of our garden, but we didn't think it warranted a 2,000 or a 1,900% increase.
What did you say? You didn't strike oil on that lot?
Yeah, when I was down testifying, I said, if I had struck oil, I'd be happy to pay a 2,000% increase, but I haven't.
Greg, are you hearing the same thing in Lykins?
We are. And what we're seeing is that the assessments are just totally all over the board. You can walk down a block and it might be a 20% increase on one house, a 200% increase on another, and a 400% increase on a third. And then you come to a house that had a 40% decrease. I mean, the vast majority of these are gigantic increases that people are very, very worried about, but they're totally all over the board.
Are you having folks come to you with those same fears that Alan described? Talk to me about your interaction with your neighbors.
You know, I have not had that directly as much. One thing I can tell you is that there are a lot of people in the Lykins neighborhood, and I think that this is the same in lots of places, that in spite of all the coverage, don't know that this is an issue. I was on a graffiti abatement project a couple of weeks ago, probably 2 or 3 weeks after the notice letters came out, and I talked with 3 homeowners who had no idea that there was an assessment change at all. There are a lot of people who, if changes aren't made, are going to have horrible adverse consequences in December and not see it coming.
Preston, what about Blue Springs? Now, you know, the general consensus is that it didn't hit quite as hard out in the suburbs, but I want to hear about what you're hearing from your people.
Well, what we still see in Blue Springs is the incredible inconsistency from house to house in the way they're assessed and the market values that are put on the rolls. But what we really don't deal with is it's not been a whole lot of impact because about 1/3 of the people in the Blue Springs School District had the magic 14.9% increase.
Yeah. Now we're going to have to talk about the magic 14.9% increase, and that has to do with state law. So briefly tell me why that is a magic number.
All right, it's a magic number, Sam, because of the 263,000 residential parcels in the Jackson County, 14.9% of those, I mean, 14.9% was the magic number increase from 2017 for 74,311. And that's just unbelievable. 28% of all the residences went up by that exact amount.
Well, and then that's important because at 15%, state law mandates that there be a physical inspection.
That's correct? Right. We know those inspections did not occur, so they went as close as they could to the standard, stay under that threshold, and that's what people got.
I do want to mention that the county believes it has fulfilled that requirement in various ways, even without just getting into the car. That's what they've said. I want to just stick with you for a second. The BOE is one of the more perplexing government units that I've covered in my life. There are voting members appointed by the county. There are non-voting members representing other taxing districts, Blue Springs schools, other school districts, other cities. So tell me what your job is. What are you doing there for Blue Springs schools on the BOE?
Well, for 12 years, I have represented the school district, and I hear all the cases and appeals that people in Blue Springs School District make. And I do vote on those cases. I decide whether the taxes should go up or down for that homeowner or business. I've done that for 12 years. Now, on the particular issue that I put forward for countywide to change the tax rate, I don't vote on that. There are 3 permanent members who do that. But under state law, the Board of Equalization actually acts like a quasi-judicial court.
Alan, I want to go back to you. What is it that... let me ask this. Do you feel like the Neighborhood Association has been overwhelmed by this? Are people constantly coming in? How are you handling this? And do you feel as if you're getting a handle on it to help folks?
Well, we're clearly not getting a handle on it. And one reason we feel that way is we believe a lot of people looked at that assessment notice, and at the top it says, this is not a bill. And most people who are struggling day to day, when they see this is not a bill, it hits the circular file in a hurry. And so we know there are a lot of people that are going to get hit hard if this is not changed in December. But in addition to that, we have reached out to Legal Aid of Western Missouri to help the elderly fill out these forms. And to expect that someone who's had no workings in the arena of property and so forth can get a appraisal and get comps and fill out the forms and get all the necessary documentation in the span initially of just a few days was unrealistic. and it's still going to be difficult even with the extension. We continue to field calls. We continue to help all those that we can get a hold of. We have called over 800 people to let them know that this is going on and that we are here to help. But we have over 4,000 residents in Ivanhoe. There's no way we can reach them all.
And just want to mention, remind people, July 29th, a week from today, is the deadline to file appeal with the BOE. Alan, do people, is there a real fear that people are going to be taxed out of their homes in your neighborhood?
At our regular monthly meeting, we had about 80 people there. And we actually had one of the committee men from Jackson County there at that meeting. And the number one fear is that the purpose for this increase was for or to help speed up gentrification. We've done a lot of work in our neighborhood over the past 30 years to make it more livable, to affect crime or decrease crime and to make it a better neighborhood to live in. And now that we have done all this work, the fear is someone else will come in and take the property because the people won't be able to maintain the taxes.
We're talking Jackson County reassessment mess. That was Alan Young, head of the Ivanhoe neighborhood, also with me. Greg Lombardi from Likens, Preston Smith, who's on the BOE representing Blue Springs Schools. I want to go back to you, Alan, very quickly and ask you whether that fear, do you share that fear of gentrification?
We fear it. We have looked forward to the possibility of it happening. As property values go up west of Troost, and we see the development quickly moving east of Troost, we are aware that developers from even outside the state are buying properties and rehabbing them, and it's driving the prices up. So, yes, it's a very real concern of ours, and we are trying to let the residents know the best thing you can do is stay in your house. Don't sell your house to these fly-by-night companies that want to offer you nothing and then move in and make a killing.
Greg, are you hearing the same thing in Likens? Is there a gentrification fear? Do folks feel like this is just a way to get them out of their homes?
And I'm actually not hearing that in Likens. Likens is a little bit... it's a wonderful neighborhood, wonderfully culturally diverse. It's been forgotten for a while, so there is not an awful lot of development that has gone on. We're starting to see that change. I have heard it from a lot of other neighborhoods that's a serious concern. And I mean, we're not so much concerned about gentrification, although that is definitely an issue, as losing people who have been in the neighborhood for years and years. They're the people who are most likely to be impacted by this are senior homeowners. And these are people who have been in the neighborhood for decades, if not generations, and have seen the neighborhood through really hard times and have been there and have, you know, called the police when they're a crime. They've gathered their neighborhoods together to pick up trash. They've done a lot of positive things. They're the backbone of the neighborhood. And they're frequently living on fixed incomes and just barely getting by month to month. And so if their property taxes increase 100% or 200%, either they're going to be forced to sell or they're going to lose their house in foreclosure or at the tax sale.
Right. Of course, just because the assessment goes up 1% or 200% doesn't necessarily mean their taxes are going to go up 1% or 200%, right? I mean, we're still a long ways from knowing exactly what, if any, tax increase there will be. Is that correct, Preston?
That's true, because the levies are not going to be set till probably the fall when the school districts decide really what they think the levies will be.
But I would add that if somebody sees a 100% increase in their assessment, their taxes are going up. It doesn't matter what the the way the city and county work, they've got to stay on an even keel with their taxes. So if the average is about 16% increase, which is what it is, people who are over the 16% increase are going to see their taxes are going to have to go up.
Right. But we're not going to know what that tax bill is till certainly the fall.
December.
Right, till December. Just confirmed this morning that the Missouri House has formed a committee to look into property tax issues around the state. And so I'm wondering What, if anything, can be done in Jefferson City? And Preston, I want to start with you on this.
Well, I met with one of the members yesterday on this committee. I got another meeting in a couple hours with another member. The truth is, they're greatly concerned here in Jackson County, and the legislators know exactly what our issues are. But statewide, we haven't gotten a whole lot of traction. So we've got really an education process with those 10 members on that committee to understand how bad it really is here.
You know, Greg, what do you think the General Assembly can do?
Well, I mean, the thing is, they can't do anything until they're in session. And unless there's an emergency session called, which I think is highly unlikely, it's going to be January before they're in session. So they're not going to be able to do anything, I think, until it's too late.
Right, but what I mean, I guess what I need to know is what certainly they can do something, because we're going to reassess every 2 years. You don't want to go through this again. So what is it that you think could be changed in Jefferson City to make this better?
Certainly, there are long-term solutions. And, for example, there's state law right now in place for St. Louis that says effectively that if you're going to have an increase that's more than 15%, you have to do a detailed inspection of the property. And if that was put in place statewide, that would be a fantastic resolution. I think that can happen, and particularly under the facts we have now, I think that there's a chance of that happening. For the short term, though, the solution has to come from either the BOE or the county or the courts. And those are all three potential sources of a solution. And it can be and should be done to help protect the low-income people of Kansas City.
Let me start with the BOE. As of close of business Friday, they had 8,700 formal appeals filed. They started last week with a docket of 90, which I'm told is not terribly unusual. But 8,700 appeals, like, how long, when would, and it's just going to keep growing, Preston, so when might we be done with that?
I tell you, the best estimates that I can come up with, even to whip through that number, 8,700, they'd be working until November just to get through those, if that's all they had. But I'm fully convinced that many of the informal appeals will be landing there too. I think the number we're looking at is clearly in excess of 25 or 30,000.
Wait, formal appeals with the Board of Equalization. That's what you're saying, 25
right.
to 30,000 formal appeals.
Well, there's a lot of the informal appeals now that can convert to formal appeals right. because the people will not settle with those.
Right. Alan, are you helping folks with these appeals process? Can you show up and help them in front of the BOE? What can the Neighborhood Association do?
Well, what we have tried to do is to be a voice for the residents at the public meetings. And that was one of the reasons why I was at that initial meeting and spoke before the BOE. We also are willing to and would love, if needed, to get residents together. And if we need to, get on a bus and go down to Jeff City. Our residents are ready to lobby wherever we need to lobby for on behalf of getting this problem taken care of.
Greg, you mentioned the courts. What can the courts do about this, in your view?
Well, it's possible to have an action for declaratory judgment under Missouri law. There are, at least it appears to be, thousands and thousands of properties where there were assessment increases of greater than 15% and no physical inspection. And a court could say, you violated the law. You cannot impose an assessment increase greater than 15%.
Somebody would have to file a lawsuit about that, correct?
There's at least one lawsuit that's already been filed.
There is the one filed on behalf of, this was filed a couple of weeks ago. Is that the one you're talking about, the one that they were hoping to turn into a class action lawsuit?
Correct. And I'm not sure if they have actually sought declaratory judgment in that case or not, but that's certainly one thing that could be done.
Yeah. Preston? The other option here is, you know, the county legislature, the county, or the county executive. What would you call on any of those or all of them to do?
Well, today I'm asking the county legislature to give me some money so that we can actually get a benchmark of county values that would actually reflect what has occurred. I found a firm in Boston that can do the guts of the programming to get market values for each parcel. And they do it in about 2 days for $4,000. And at this point, there is no reflection of market values in any of the assessment data. That'll give us a benchmark and an idea of what value should be, and from there we can build and actually create an assessment that would make sense.
Jackson County Legislature meets here in about 90 minutes. Are you saying you're going to be before them?
I'm not
meeting with them.
I'm not presenting today. I haven't even presented the memo to them yet. I'm going to do that this afternoon. But I let them know that this was information the Board of Equalization wanted me to provide last week. So we're providing it to show here's how we can do this and actually get some numbers that make sense.
Alan Young, do you think the county has abandoned folks of lower means, older folks, people who have been in their neighborhood homes in some cases for generations? You feel the county has abandoned you?
Well, I don't know if I feel abandoned. I believe that there was a purpose and a reason behind it that was not fair. And to me, these increases should have never gotten out the door. They should never have been mailed. No resident in this county should get an increase of over 2,000% on their property. And someone should have called it before it went out. And why, I'm not sure, but most of the people that I have talked to, come across in the neighborhood, believe the motive was to get people out of their property so the developers could come in and buy things at lower price and then reap a profit.
Frank White, the county executive, Gail McCann Beatty, who directs the assessment department, both say that they're just following state law, that the county has been underassessed for a long time for whatever reason that you want to pick. But now there was going to be some pain. It's going to happen now, and they want to be in compliance with state law. So I want to hear from all three of you about to react to that.
Tell you what, Sam, I did an analysis last week. It clearly shows that they targeted the minority areas with a lot of these tax increases. The about 50-square-mile area in the center of the city had the largest tax increases, twice as much as elsewhere in the county, and they targeted that area. For whatever reason, I don't know. But the data's there, and it's very clear that they did not get the 14.9%. They got the 1,000% increases. So they were targeted.
Greg Lombardi?
And I would say that their premise is great, and the basic goal is a very laudable goal. That, I mean, the assessments have been off in Jackson County for a long, long time. It was a brave and laudable thing for them to correct that. But the process they put in place is just absolutely wrong. That one, doing this, they should have told people 9 months or a year ago that this process was in place, and they should have been open and transparent about it, which they haven't done at all. And the numbers that they have come up with are so wide over the board. I would bet you I can put together a list of 20 properties. I can take the best assessor from Jackson County out and show them these properties. There is no way that they would come in within 20% accuracy on them. And I am really afraid that what they're doing is they're undermining people's faith in government, because what has happened here is there's really clear mistakes that were made in this process. Some that's clear violation of law, and some where it just seems like there's no rhyme or reason to the action they've taken. And yet, the county's position is not to act like there's been no problem at all. And to say if people have a problem, they just will appeal it, and that's the solution. When a county doesn't respond to its people, when a county doesn't admit that there is a problem, when there clearly are problems, people lose faith in government. And that's a giant piece of fallout from this.
Losing faith in government may be happening. I do want to point out, though, that the county has admitted that there have been problems. They sat in these chairs in here and admitted it. Now, how they're going to fix it is clearly up in the air, but I don't think they have denied that there's a problem. They may not believe that it's at quite the level that you guys do. And Alan, I want to give you the last word here. What are you advising your friends and neighbors in Ivanhoe?
Well, as best we can, we are trying to get the word out, and we are willing at the Ivanhoe Neighbor Council to help anyone that's in the vicinity in the urban core that needs help filling these forms out. We're also trying to get the people to be more cognizant of the issues that will affect their lives, because we believe a lot of people don't really even realize what's going on. So we're, again, trying to get the word out and trying to help those that need to get these forms filled out and get them in.
Alan Young, head of the Ivanhoe Neighborhood, thanks for coming in. Also today, Greg Lombardi from Likens Neighborhood. Greg, thank you. Preston Smith, you've got a busy few days. I appreciate you taking some time out to join us here on Up to Date. Thank you all very much. Just ahead, what contributes to toxic masculinity, and is there such a thing as toxic femininity? I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Sam Zeff, in for Steve Kraske. Friday on the program, we learned how one Kansas City artist uses weather balloons and a video camera to create art. Hear that conversation and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. A reminder for Wednesday, KCUR will carry NPR's live coverage of Robert Mueller's testimony before Congress in its entirety beginning at 7:30 in the morning. Holy Archibald Cox, you're not going to want to miss that. So when I read about toxic masculinity, the first thing I thought about was what I used to tell my son when he was a kid, that the boys will be boys break that I experienced doesn't exist anymore. But does it? Joining me to talk about such things is Dr. Ronald Levant, who is a clinical psychologist and professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Akron. He joined us from WKSU at Kent State University. Dr. Levant, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And joining me from the Tapeworks studio in Hartford, Connecticut, is Dr. Wisdom Powell, director of the Health Disparities Institute and an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut Health System. Dr. Powell, it is a pleasure to have you on Up to Date.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I'm going to start with a basic question here and ask both of you to define, as you see it, toxic masculinity. Dr. Levant, I'll start with you.
Okay, well, toxic masculinity is a media term. It's not a psychological term. And what we have been talking about as psychologists is how rigid gender roles, both masculine and feminine, that were prominent right after World War II, and no longer work very well, given all the changes that have taken place in society and women's roles and an acceptance of non-heterosexual lifestyles and the like. So toxic masculinity, you know, is something that, you know, is popular in the media. As psychologists, we refer to traditional masculinity ideology, that is beliefs, you know, about how boys and men should think, feel, and behave.
Dr. Powell, how do you define it?
I would also agree with Dr. Levant that the term toxic masculinity is not a scientific one, and I think it's by itself problematic in the way that we use it, because it really infers that men and boys are somehow inherently or irreparably toxic. And even though we try to qualify the term when used in media, people often hear that as a disclaimer for all men and all boys. And I actually think that the message about masculinity is more positive than the term toxic masculinity has led us to believe.
Talk to me about the positive aspects.
Well, men and boys are dynamic, adaptive human beings who are capable of a broad range of behaviors and emotions. And male behavior is not necessarily tied to a particular way of being in the world. Men are adapting situation to situation and moment to moment. So positive aspects of masculinity include things like heroism and strength and bravery and, you know, courage and conviction and compassion. All of those elements of human lived capability reside in men and boys. And I think we need to be talking about that alongside the conversations we're having about the ways in which men and boys are sometimes led to believe that behaving in ways that are damaging to relationships are the only way to be a man.
Ronald, do you see that in the same way that that there is part of masculinity is that heroic nature? Talk to me about what you see as the positive aspects of that, if you see those at all.
Well, I think let me just talk about the other end of it, about what's harmful about masculinity.
Yeah.
There's three things that I see that's harmful. First is that most boys are led to believe that conforming to these traditional, stereotypical, patriarchal norms of avoiding anything feminine and restricting the expression of emotions and being aggressive and tough and dominant are the only way to be. That is, masculinity is presented to boys as essentially obligatory. The second thing is that there are about 40 years of research in our field that has shown that measures of traditional masculinity are associated with a broad range of harmful outcomes. That doesn't mean that every man or boy engages in the harmful outcomes. In fact, my research shows that it's really those at the upper tail of the distribution, that is, who have very high beliefs that men should be in this stereotypical manner. It's those folks whose scores are associated with harmful outcomes like aggression and violence, negative attitudes towards sexual and racial minorities, negative attitudes towards parental involvement, and suicide and substance abuse and other things of that nature. So it's really extremely rigid beliefs in traditional masculinity that cause trouble. And my research also shows that most men do not strongly believe in those norms. Most men, they might be told as children that they have to be this way, but as adults, they realize they're not. Masculinity is an impossible standard, and most people come to accept that they're not the most masculine guy in the world. And hey, that's okay. I am who I am. And they just go on about their lives. It's those that hold on to the extreme definitions that we think are the source of the problem.
So I do want you to answer the question about whether there are some positive aspects of masculinity, but I want to come back to what you just said before. But are there some positive aspects as Wisdom described?
Yeah, one of our colleagues, Ryan McDermott, did a recent study where he asked a large number of participants for attributions or personality traits that are more typical of men, more typical of women, and that are positive or negative. And he came up with, you know, a substantial list of terms that are considered more appropriate for men and boys and positive. And some of those are the ones that Dr. Powell mentioned earlier, like, you know, heroism and courage and being able to basically be calm in the face of danger and things of that nature. So it's really, you know, the ability to produce those behaviors when required that refers to the positive aspects of masculinity. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Dr. Powell, I want to ask about toxic femininity in a moment, but first, your research centers a lot about how this affects health, especially among African-American men. How does all of this discussion play into that?
Well, I mean, one thing that we've learned from research that we've conducted is that Black men and boys define masculinities in markedly different ways than one might presume non-Hispanic white men define them. And that's principally because masculinity definitions are shaped in context, and the social situations and arrangements that Black men and boys find themselves in are markedly different from those that non-Hispanic white men typically find themselves in. So that's where we see the difference. And there we see Black men and boys defining masculinity in really positive terms, talking about masculinities as an opportunity to redeem oneself, to go about, enacting a proactive course of behavior, both in relationship to their families and in their communities in the workplace. And we found some really interesting things when we look at the associations between Black men's definitions of masculinities and health outcomes. So, you know, on the consistent side of the research, meaning the research that mirrors much of what Dr. Levant has described, we've found that when Black men hold rigidly to masculinity norms that encourage them to habitually restrict their emotion or shut down their emotions, that they have more depressive symptoms. And that's consistent with a large body of research. But we also find that Black men who actually adhere strongly to norms that encourage self-reliance and more self-determination, we also see that they are less likely to delay health services seeking. So, in other words, masculinity norms can be leveraged for positive benefit for Black men when it comes to help-seeking behaviors, particularly screening behaviors. And here's why that's important, because I think much of the message around masculinities and its association with health has been sort of showing a more negative association that masculinities lead to harmful outcomes. And we're showing that actually in some situations, in some contexts, and in some populations, masculinity norms actually could contribute to better health outcomes. And I think our challenge as scientists is to really determine in what situations, under what circumstances and context do these norms or beliefs about what it means to be a man impact health in positive and negative ways so that we can refine interventions and change the narrative, really, around how we describe and discuss masculinity and its impact on the health and well-being of boys and men.
That's Dr. Wisdom Powell. She's Director of Health Disparities and Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Connecticut. We're talking about toxic masculinity. And I want to ask you, Dr. Powell, so after saying all of that, what is it that we can do as health professionals, as educators, in the media, to get to improve these health outcomes for some of these young African-American men?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is accept that we are all complicit in maintaining this idea of masculinity that is mythic and difficult to achieve, as Dr. Levant pointed out. I think these messages and their transmission start very, very early in the life course. You know, when boys are beginning to play on playgrounds anywhere USA, we often tell them that, you know, when they fall down that they shouldn't cry and that they should be able to walk it off and take it like a man. And I think if we can cease and desist on those kinds of messages as a human family and community, that we would be doing a better service. I think we also have to think about particular structural arrangements for racial and ethnic minority males like Black men and boys that actually make it even more likely that men will push back from seeking the help that they need. And these arrangements include, you know, sort of structural disadvantage like racism that can, you know, interact with men's beliefs about what it means to be a man to negatively impact their health. So we need systems change in addition to all of the efforts we're making to change individual level behavior so that we make it possible for boys and men to enact masculinities that really, really convey the dynamic, broad range of behaviors and emotions that they're capable of displaying.
Dr. Levant, how would you change everything to make this better?
Well, I would try to educate people that masculinity is really not essential to being a male. That is really a social idea that has changed throughout history. Just give you one example. One prominent masculine norm is restrictive affectionate behavior between men. That is, men are not supposed to show affection to each other. Yet in the 19th century, that was the norm was opposite. Men could be affectionate with each other. They Abraham Lincoln slept in the same bed with another man. So these norms obviously are historically changeable. And I think what we need to do is kind of help people understand that masculinity is separate from whether you are male or female, and that it's voluntary, not obligatory, and that there may be some masculine standards that fit your personality. I mean, after all, everyone's personality varies a lot, and there may be some masculine standards that really aren't you, and you don't have to enact them.
Is this Dr. Levant, is this an American thing? Is it a Western culture thing? What kind of thing is this?
It's more of a Western cultural thing, and part of the global north. It really represents the dominant group in the global north, which are white, heterosexual, cisgendered men. You know, and the values or standards that are applied to them. Even though within the global north, as Dr. Powell's has explained, there are variations in different racial and ethnic groups, different age groups, for example. I have some students that are developing a questionnaire for millennials, and we're finding that millennials kind of have a different take on masculinity. I mean, for one thing, they don't hold to that rigid standard of having disdain for non-heterosexual men, okay? That somehow there's greater acceptance of sexual orientation diversity, gender diversity. And that's very different from my generation, which is the boomers or even the ones that followed it. So even age cohort can make a big difference in how people view masculinity.
Dr. Powell, if there is toxic masculinity, is there toxic femininity?
So, you know, I struggle with the use of the term toxic to define anyone's behavior or outcomes, except if we qualify those as situational, contextual enactments. But I would argue that there are ways that we behave that are toxic, regardless of which gendered body or gendered lived experience that we enact from day to day. So yes, it's possible that women or those who define themselves as women can enact behaviors and norms and behave in situations that are harmful and potentially toxic. But inherently deterministically toxic, I would say no, because I don't believe that that is a plausible way of being in the world for any human, right? I do believe that behaviors erupt in relationships, in situations, and from moment to moment.
If I could tag on to that.
Yes, of course.
I think, you know, we're really not talking about this toxic term, as I said, but there's aspects that rigid gender roles, either masculinity or femininity, can be problematic. But masculinity tends to be more problematic than femininity and is associated with a greater range of problematic outcomes than femininity. And the reason for that is that femininity is essentially attributed to women as a result of physical maturation. When a woman, you know, when a girl reaches womanhood, she's accorded the status of a woman and she's presumed to be feminine. Boys, on the other hand, as I said, they're told that masculinity is obligatory, but they have to prove it every time it becomes an issue. So masculinity is more contested than femininity, and I think, therefore, is more problematic. One of the things we find is that with many men, you know, of all walks of life, that when you threaten their masculinity by forcing them to perform a task that is stereotypically feminine, like braiding hair on a mannequin and putting pink ribbons on it, that they respond with aggression. That the idea that you're somehow taking their masculinity away is deeply threatening to many men, and that they will respond aggressively. So I think masculinity as a traditional gender role is more problematic than femininity as a traditional gender role.
Dr. Powell, you're the woman on the panel here, so I believe I need to hear from you on this.
Well, I mean, I think Dr. Levant's points are really sound, and I would just qualify them a bit by saying that the precariousness with which he associates with masculinities is especially felt by men who are operating at society's margins, because masculinities are hierarchical arrangements in some ways. And so men with less power, privilege, and access to opportunity are going to feel the brunt of that, the pressure, right, to perform a particular brand of masculinities. But I would also argue that in similar ways, women of color, their femininities are also quite precarious because of the traditional sort of prescriptions of femininity were not really widely applied to women of color, right? They weren't afforded the same sort of expectations or feminine privileges, if you will. And so proving one's femininity and standing ground around those aspects of femininities are particularly difficult for women of color who've had all kinds of challenges to their gender role performance that have been mounted over time and throughout history. So, yes, I agree. Masculinities are precarious. Men have to fight and for them and win them all the time, and they face repetitive tests to prove masculinities. But I would argue that for some women and girls, those same tests apply.
Dr. Levant, you know, as I was reading up on this, it occurred to me that when I turn on the news, I see a lot of toxic masculinity. And I'm wondering if you have the same feeling, whether perhaps in our zeitgeist this has bubbled up to a level that we haven't seen in a while. What do you think about that?
Well, at the risk of getting a little political, I think we're living in a time in which traditional masculinity is sort of being reasserted violently from the top of our government of the United States on down, that so much of what we're seeing in terms of what we talk about is sort of, you know, a society of divisiveness and struggle and strife ever since 2016. You know, I think is a result of kind of the reassertion, particularly by the President of the United States, of a very harsh, rigid, traditional form of masculinity. His approach to dealing with allies is the approach of a fifth grade student, essentially to bully people into submission. So I think what this has done, as a matter of fact, has actually empowered men who adhere to these traditional stereotypes to be more bold about it and to push back against women who are, you know, asserting their rights. I do want to add, though, that I think Dr. Powell's points are really important, that the differences for people of color, men or women, because of the added dimensions of racism, because of the historical trauma inflicted on African Americans in this country, is much more difficult, much more complicated, but also, interestingly, for some African American men, much broader, that they've come to define masculinity as service to the community, to the family, and so forth, that includes elements that aren't part of traditional masculinity.
And Dr. Powell, real quickly, I want to get your thought on this. Is masculinity raging out of control in the current zeitgeist of America?
I would absolutely agree with Ron that we're seeing this reassertion of more traditional or stereotypic masculinity, and along with it, an expectation that all men would conform to that way of being in the world or be bullied or pushed out. And I think that's really problematic for men and boys who are operating with a broader sort of definition of masculinities, because those men and boys also have the right to be able to feel and emote in ways that are consistent with their identity and not be pushed into the man box, really. And, you know, I think, you know, the thing that we have to be talking about even more so now is how do we get boys and men to resist making those blind investments in rigidly sustaining and displaying stereotypical masculinities, especially in this time, because the return on those investments are minimal, especially when boys and men are standing at emotional cliffs.
Dr. Wisdom Powell, thank you for joining us. I hate to cut you off, but we have to move aside here. Dr. Wisdom Powell, thank you, and Dr. Ronald Levant, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Tomorrow, we'll talk with a member of the FEMA team here in Missouri, assisting residents affected by the severe flooding. I'm Sam Zeff. You're up to date.